You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of April, 2013, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One here in London with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, drones, Iran, and Syria. We take a look at the three big stories affecting the Middle East this morning with Jane Kinnamon, Senior Research Fellow at Chatham House, for today's agenda setter.
If you've just bought a high-definition TV, well done, but you may already be behind the game. We'll be in Los Angeles to find out why something called 4K will soon replace HD.
We'll head down under to take the temperature of Australia's morning TV landscape.
And in this week's preview of The Entrepreneurs, we find out what it takes to try and rebrand a piece of Antarctica.
There's lots of areas there that are rich in terms of what we can bring alive, the harmony, the fact that we were bringing diverse thinkers together in the scientific community, and then also the fact that we were trying to rally the world's key thinkers around the project and get them to get involved.
All that, plus we'll play some music as well, including a song that Steve's been humming all morning. So that's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
It's true. I've been slightly annoying everyone in the office with my humming and indeed singing. But don't worry, you will be too after you've heard it. So as ever, a lot to pack in over the next hour. But first, here's Barney Burnham with the latest news headlines for around the world.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. Charges against the Mississippi man accused of sending ricin-laced letters to President Obama and two other officials have been dropped. Paul Kevin Curtis had been arrested last Wednesday and charged with sending letters containing the poison to the president, to Mississippi Senator Roger Wicker, and to a state judge. A search of his home at the weekend failed to find incriminating evidence against him, and his lawyer claims he was framed. Law enforcement officials have begun searching the home of a second suspect. Mr. Curtis says he's relieved that his ordeal is over.
I respect President Obama. I love my country, and would never do anything to pose a threat to him or any other U.S. official. This past week has been a nightmare for myself and my family. My mother has suffered, as well as my children. I would like to get back to normal.
An eight-story block housing garment factories and a shopping centre has collapsed on the outskirts of the Bangladeshi capital Dhaka, killing at least 25 people and injuring more than 500. A senior official said factory owners appeared to have ignored a warning not to allow workers into the building after a crack was detected in the block the previous day. In November last year, 112 workers were killed in a blaze at a clothing factory in an industrial suburb of Dhaka. It's being reported that the name of Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the Boston Marathon bombing suspect killed in last week's manhunt, was on the US government's list of potential terrorists. But sources close to the investigation say the list is so vast that his inclusion did not mean authorities automatically kept close tabs on him. Lawyers for Tamerlan Tsarnaev's widow, Catherine Russell, say she's doing all she can to assist the authorities. Miriam Weizenbaum says her client is still trying to come to terms with what's happened.
The injuries and loss of life to people who came to celebrate a race and a holiday has caused profound distress and sorrow to Katie and her family. The reports of involvement by her husband and brother-in-law came as an absolute shock to them all.
Two men arrested on Monday and accused of plotting a bomb attack on a Canadian passenger train have been challenging the case against them. The authorities say their alleged plot had the support of Al-Qaeda in Iran. 30-year-old Chileb Essegaya, believed to be of Tunisian origin, told a Montreal court that the case against him was based only on appearances. 35-year-old Raed Jazer, who has lived in Canada for 20 years but is understood to be a United Arab Emirates national of Palestinian origin, appeared in court in Toronto. His lawyer, John Norris, says he denies all the allegations and will be defending himself vigorously.
He's in a state of shock and disbelief. He's anxious to see the evidence that the Crown says that it has against him, and we will move forward in that way.
Afghanistan's President Hamid Karzai will hold talks today with the US Secretary of State John Kerry and officials from Pakistan. It's an attempt to improve relations between the neighbours after Afghanistan said earlier this week that its patience with Pakistan was wearing thin following border disputes and rows over the Afghan peace process. NATO's Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen says both countries must work together.
We need a positive engagement of Pakistan if we are to ensure long-term peace and stability, not only in Afghanistan, but in the region. The Pakistani people is also victim of terrorism. Pakistan and Afghanistan have a mutual interest in fighting extremism.
The planned sale of 630 UK bank branches by Lloyds Banking Group to the Co-op Group has fallen through, leaving state-backed Lloyds to pursue a flotation of the business. The Co-op said it had pulled out of the deal because of tough regulator requirements and the worsening outlook for UK economic growth. The deal, agreed last year, would have created Britain's seventh biggest bank with about 5% of personal current accounts and mortgage market and about 10% of the branch network. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. Barney will be back in about 24 minutes with another check of the world headlines. It's 8:06 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, see on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. Time now, as ever on this show, to set the day's agenda. We ask our experts to choose the three big stories we'll need to know in the next 24 hours.
And joining us to set today's agenda is Jane Kinnamon, Senior Research Fellow at Chatham House and regular Monocle 24 contributor. Thanks very much, Jane, for coming into the studio. One of the stories we want to begin with is what's happening in Syria.
Good morning. Well, Syria is never far from the top of the agenda in the Middle East these days. There's been a statement this morning by an EU anti-terror official estimating now that there are some 500 European nationals engaged in the fighting in Syria against the Assad government forces, and that the three countries that provided the most nationals were the UK, Ireland and France. I think really it emphasises how globalised the Syria issue has become.
Now, obviously, you know, over the last year or so, there's been all sorts of reports of foreign nationals entering Syria to helping the rebels. And in a sense, that's helped Bashar al-Assad with his propaganda, hasn't it? Because he's been able to say, look, this is a foreign plot to try and take over the Syrian government.
That's absolutely right. At the end of the day, these numbers are still fairly small compared to the total population. And this is something that started out as a peaceful domestic uprising against dictatorships. But the Syrian government has a fairly paranoid mentality anyway. But they certainly do remember the kind of threats that were made against them by many discussions and analysis around the time of the Iraq war. There was a lot of talk about would Syria be next, and I think they probably do see this as all part of some conspiratorial master plan.
So we have 500 fighters from the EU, from the UK, Ireland, France, making up the largest chunk. What do we know about these individuals, if anything, and do we know whether, in a sense, they've become radicalised at all?
We don't know very much. I think this is becoming an increasing priority for intelligence officials here in the UK, where we're sitting today, and in other European countries, that where Syria was very, very heavily focused on by foreign ministries. Now you're seeing domestic anti-radicalisation officials getting more concerned and certainly wondering, you know, if they weren't radicalised when they got there, what's going to happen to them when they come back?
I want to move on to another story, which we've touched on a fair bit over the last couple of years, always in the background. This is the use of drones by the Obama administration. There's a Yemeni journalist who's going to be testifying in the Senate today about the human cost of drones there. You know, it's one of those countries where drones have been used an awful lot, although there's very little coverage of it. The White House doesn't seem too interested in engaging the issue, does it?
No, I mean, one of the whole issues around drone warfare is the secrecy that it is clouded in. And certainly in Pakistan, there's been a lot of anti-American sentiment driven by the drone warfare. We're seeing Imran Khan, one of the candidates in the elections, really capitalising on this anger that's there. That's growing also in the Middle East, especially in Yemen, where drone attacks have only been increasing since the popular uprising changed their president there. And this really is something that is bringing it more into the consciousness of the US public, most of whom probably don't really know what's being done.
But outside of the White House, you said there's anger growing on the streets against the drone program. But within the Obama administration, it has been extremely successful for them. Does it seem like they're going to budge at all?
So far, it doesn't seem like there's any desire to change the policies. And you've had, you know, quite strong pushback at yesterday's hearing from a former army official who was saying that even using the word drones is actually taking part in Al-Qaeda propaganda and that you should just talk about unmanned aerial vehicles.
Interesting. Interesting. Yeah, I think you'd probably still call it a drone if it's bombing your village. Let's talk about the hypocrisy of liberals. Why not? When the drone program was being carried out under the George W. Bush administration, liberals were up in arms about it. They said it was outrageous. It shouldn't carry on. Obama hasn't just continued it. He's actually increased the number.
Yes.
Why do you think that the left in the US and liberals in the US have been so silent about this?
Probably it reflects this very partisan political debate that you have in the US, despite the fact that when it comes to foreign policy, not that much tends to change from administration to administration. And, you know, we could look also at Guantanamo Bay, the continued existence of that. I think there can be a tendency to overstate the differences.
And during these Senate hearings, a former Joint Chiefs Chairman General, James Cartwright, now retired, he had this statement. He said, "I'm concerned we might have ceded some of our moral high ground in relation to this drone program." How much do you think this argument, the moral high ground argument, will have in the coming months or even years in terms of the drone program?
Well, this is at the core of the dilemmas around the war on terror, and it was seen also with the arrest of the Boston Marathon bombing suspect and the debate over, you know, do you try him in a civilian court and uphold rights and, you know, constitutional processes, or do you try to define him as an enemy combatant? It's interesting that drones have even made their way into the latest Tom Cruise movie, Oblivion. So it is something I think that the public can understand if it's discussed with them.
And just finally this morning, let's touch on this story on tensions between Gulf states and Iran. There are three islands in the Gulf that are claimed by United Arab Emirates, but they're occupied by Iran. It's, if you like, it's the Senkaku Islands of the Gulf. And some Iranian MPs will be visiting these islands.
That's right. And this is one of these territorial disputes that rarely gets any coverage. Few international governments care very much about it. But for the UAE, which claims this island, it is a huge deal. And there are these tensions getting worse between Iran and the Gulf, mainly over Syria. This is just another flashpoint, another thing that could drive up those tensions in the area where, you know, vast amount of the world's oil comes from.
Do we know much about the natural resources that might be on the islands, minerals, or is it essentially just a rock in the ocean as like the Senkaku Islands?
More than anything, it's a symbolic issue. There's even tension between Iran and the UAE over whether you call the Gulf the Persian Gulf, as Iran does, or the Arabian Gulf, as the UAE does. Again, coming back to semantics and how important they are in politics.
Jane Kinnamon, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. Senior Research Fellow at Chatham House. Thanks very much for coming in.
Great to see you. Goodbye.
Coming up, we'll be discussing Sony's plans to replace your HDTV. I know you'd only just bought it, hadn't you?
House Vision in Tokyo is an exhibition that combines the wisdom of Japan's best creative thinkers with state-of-the-art technology. Curated by the visionary designer Kenyahara, the mission was to explore new and unconventional ways of urban living.
Japan's post-war growth spurt might have brought wealth, but one of the great ironies is that despite rising incomes, most Japanese live in homes that are cramped and uniformly bland. For all the expert craftsmanship that goes into building homes here, rarely do they last more than a generation.
House Vision, a Future Perfect film from Tokyo on Monocle.com.
Section D is the show you listen to for the untold stories, secrets, and blazing headlines in the design sphere. The architects, fashion followers, artists, and engineers who are making and breaking the trends across the world.
When Valentino touches the clothes, you see his hands tracing those lines of shape, form, and to see Valentino arranging one of his dresses is to understand the dress in terms of structure.
Join me, Hugo MacDonald, for an hour of insight, interviews, and discussion every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Steve Bloomfield. The time here in London is 8:15. LED, LCD, Super HD, 3D. Steve, are you confused?
Yes.
Well, choosing the right kind of TV to mount on your wall can be a long and complicated and often a confusing process. Well, get ready because things are about to get a whole lot more complicated.
Yes, you can now add 4K to that list. Sony are unveiling their new range of screen technologies that they say could one day replace the HD TV that some of us have just bought. Well, to find out more about 4K TVs and if they live up to the hype is Monocle's technology correspondent David Phelan. David joins us on the line from Los Angeles, where he's just been seeing Sony's new unveiling. David, good evening, good morning, whatever time it feels like to you. Hello. What can you tell us about 4K TVs?
Well, I can tell you they are pretty impressive, and I think if Sony has its way, they'll replace those HD TVs pretty soon, because they're pretty well advanced. There's one screen available at the moment from Sony, an 84-inch whopper that costs £25,000. But the two that they've revealed in great detail today are about to go on sale for $5,000 each. And these are smaller but still enormous screens, 65-inch and 55-inch across the diagonal. But because they have four times the number of pixels of a full HD TV, the level of detail is incredible. Sony's contention is that they make movies, they make the professional 4K cameras, they make every stage of, as they call it, from the lens to the living room. So they understand very well how this can work. And they showed us in enormous detail, not only the TVs, but the color restoration and how 4K will be absolutely normal for everyone within the next 5 or 6, 10 years at the outside.
And David, with a lot of these kind of launches, there's a lot of hype, there's a lot of excitement, just like the 3D TVs had when they first launched. A lot of people go out and buy them, but they don't really catch on in the long run. Do you think 4K TVs will follow the same route that the 3D TV has followed?
It's a good question. Certainly there's been plenty of hype here. We've been touring Sony's film studios so they can prove that they make movies. We even went... I stood on the original Yellow Brick Road,
proud
to tell
you.
Yes, to tell you, it is literally just one brick. There's only one yellow brick from the Yellow Brick Road left.
Is that because people have just nicked them all?
No, they took the other ones up and left one as a symbol of where the movie was made. But I think what's different this time from 3D is that there's no issue with wearing glasses. There's no problem about whether people actually want it or not. If you just see a 4K TV, the level of detail is remarkable. And one of the things that I'm not sure that it's necessarily Sony's message, but one of the things that became apparent during today's briefings is that actually there hasn't been a format of as good a quality as 35mm film until now. VHS, DVD, standard definition, even high definition, don't have enough information in them to match 35mm film. And this 4K finally meets it and perhaps even exceeds it. So it is a whole new level of quality.
David, just finally, I want to ask you, you know, you go to a lot of these launches, you've seen, you know, all these TVs launched before before they've got into our living rooms. At each stage, do you look at it and go, wow, that's better than ever. I can't see how they can possibly improve. Or are there other times you look at it and go, well, that's good, but I can imagine it being even better?
It's a mixture of the two. Certainly today, some of the things we were hearing is that there comes a point where you don't need to improve any further because there's a limit to how much information the human eye can take in. And 4K isn't it, I'm afraid. There's going to be 8K and possibly even 16K.
Really?
But the level of quality is so astonishing now. Yes, it does take your breath away.
Well, David, I'm looking forward to my my TV that you will bring over for me, hopefully from LA. Very excited for that. Monocle's technology correspondent, David Phelan, in LA.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦. 这是 Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monaco 24.
Now, every day this week on Midori House, we're featuring some of the stories that feature in issue 63 of Monocle magazine, available at all good newsstands now.
And today we're turning our attention to Australia, a country of only 22 million people, but with a morning television market as crowded and competitive as the Americans. Forget morning swims at Bronte or jogs along the Yarra River. If the ratings war is anything to go by, Australians are perched in front of their TVs. Well, joining us now for more is Monocle's Melbourne correspondent, Patrick Pittman. Patrick, thanks very much for joining us here on Midori House. I used to live in Australia, so I know how competitive that market is. The two big players on morning television, Sunrise, and the Today Show battling out, and they're still battling out all these years later.
Yeah, it's a rough fight since Channel 7 launched its Sunrise show about 10 years ago and completely shook up an industry down here. And, you know, Today had been around since the 80s and weren't really expecting it to come, but the fight's been going ever since then.
Now, Patrick, we've got a couple of clips from a couple of top media people within Australia. We want to play those and then we'll come back to you. First of all, let's hear from Gary Linnell, editorial director of Metro Media at Fairfax.
The platforms, the technology, the org structures, you know, how we look at audiences, all the data, all that stuff, that'll keep evolving and changing. Well, the thirst for a great story doesn't change.
Well, and
it moves audiences.
In fact, we don't have a journalism problem and we don't have an audience problem here. I mean, you know, our audiences are bigger now than they've ever been in the history of Fairfax. Our journalism is as good as it's ever been in the history of Fairfax. We have a business model problem.
That was Gary Linnell and then Jack Matthews, CEO of Metro Media at Fairfax. Now let's hear from Neil Breen, who's the executive producer of The Today Show.
When I was a teenager and a child, our house only ever had two networks on, Nine and the ABC. We never watched Seven, we never watched Ten. My parents didn't watch them. So that was kind of a cultural thing. If you were from Queensland, you drank 4X, and if you were from New South Wales, you drank Tui's. Well, that doesn't apply anymore either. People are consuming all sorts of different beer and stuff. Same as with TV.
That was Neil Breen, the executive producer of Today's Show, with a, well, I think you agree, Patrick, a very Australian metaphor there.
I don't think we could have gotten any more Australian than Neil Breen there.
No, indeed. Now, tell us a bit about Neil Breen and the role that he's playing on Today.
Well, he's actually only just recently arrived there. He was the editor of the Sunday Telegraph, one of Rupert Murdoch's big tabloid newspapers in Sydney. So he's just walked into that role in the last few months and has sort of been given the job of winning the ratings back for Today. And he's been doing all right so far this year. Today's been kind of doing well and crawling back what Sunrise took away. But yeah, Neil's an interesting character with that real sort of old school tabloid kind of mentality.
And on the other end of the spectrum, we had Adam Boland, who essentially revived the fortunes for Sunrise on Channel 7 quite a few years ago. Simon Powell, his predecessor, is now the man in charge. Sunrise still, though, dominating the television ratings, although by not as much of a margin as I think they would like. How you know, how precarious is Sunrise's position?
Oh, look, there's just a few thousand in it most weeks. It really, it goes up and down depending on who gets what traction with which issues and who's got these politicians on. So really, it's day by day and there's almost nothing in it. The big risk is, you know, everybody's waiting to see what Channel 10 will do because, as you mentioned, Adam Bolander, who shook everything up at Sunrise, and Channel 10 have just hired him and have not yet really announced what their plans are with him.
In terms of TV generally, Patrick, how important are the morning shows in terms of advertising and in terms of sort of making sure that people stick with that channel throughout the day?
They've been traditionally very important in that old school kind of way of, you know, you turn the TV on in the morning and that's the station you stay with. But even now these days, as people are jumping around a lot more, they still do remain probably one of the only places where advertisers can connect to a really broad audience that changes over the course of those hours in the morning. And I mean, the other thing is a lot of the media analysts, when they're looking at how these networks are performing, this is where they jump to first, is just to say, how are those breakfast shows doing? And when 10 completely failed with their last attempt, you know, that had the network was considered to be on the ropes.
So give us a sense of these networks. There's Channel 9, Channel 7, and Network 10, the three big commercial broadcasters in Australia. Give us a sense of their audiences. I understand Network 10 obviously caters for a bit of a younger audience. What about Channel 7 and Channel 9?
Well, Channel 9 is probably your most traditional of the audiences. That's your probably skewing sort of 40 and upwards. They have a lot of the more mainstream kind of entertainment in the evening. Channel 7 and Channel 9 are rather similar, a lot of reality shows, that kind of thing. Channel 10's trouble is they've traditionally focused on the 16 to 35 kind of viewership market, which used to be something that advertisers really wanted and was really valuable, but the issue is that market isn't really watching television anymore, so 10's finding itself in a lot of trouble in trying to maybe skew upwards a little bit in its demographic now.
And now, Patrick, obviously TV isn't the only thing in the mornings, as we well know. There's radio as well. Let's talk a little bit about the morning scene for radio in Australia. How thriving is it at the moment?
Well, traditionally, the call-in radio, or talkback, as we call it in Australia, has been phenomenally influential on the political scene, on the cultural scene, with hosts like Alan Jones and that kind of person. You know, governments can rise and fall on their opinions. That's on the wane a little bit. There's a new breed of commercial breakfast presenter, the likes of Carl Sanderlins and Jackie O, who are on Sydney's Today FM. They have a much more kind of controversy-based approach to things, you might say, kindly. And that's where a lot of the radio ratings are going at the moment.
Well, I just wanted to touch on that point. You mentioned, the shock jock radio hosts that are on 2GB, 2UE. Those are the big kind of talk call-in shows. There's also the music shows on Today, Nova. What role is ABC Radio, breakfast radio, playing?
A very, very large role. I spoke to Fran Kelly from ABC's Radio National for this piece, and that's still the show that really does set the debate for the day when it comes to policy and when it comes to the people that are talking about those things. Everybody wakes up in the morning and turns on breakfast on Radio National because that's where the politicians have to go first, and that's where the stories really do roll out in the mornings. And so obviously it's a much smaller audience than those big commercial stations, but in terms of influence, it's up there.
Patrick, we've done TV, we've done radio. Let's talk about print, although obviously it's a little bit depressing, isn't it? You've got the Melbourne Age, you've got Sydney Morning Herald, we've got the Australian, but none of them are really doing that well at the moment, are they?
No, not particularly well. Look, the Australian's never been a huge seller of a paper. It's kind of a flagship for Rupert Murdoch's News Limited, but it's never sold anything like those metropolitan dailies. The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald, you know, they're in trouble, there's no denying that. But what the people at Fairfax have been trying to do in the last few years, they've been, you know, flailing around trying to find a business structure. Honestly, it feels like now, I mean, this year they've shifted to tabloid format, or compact as they call it, don't mention the T word, and a lot of other sort of changes around that with the tablet things. They're doing all right. They're doing well. It feels like they're finding a way forward. They have lost a lot of good journalists in the last couple of years as well. A lot of them are jumping over to The Guardian, who are coming down here. So, yeah, it's interesting times.
It is indeed. Patrick Pittman, our Melbourne correspondent, thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House. And of course, you can read Patrick's big piece on mornings in Australia, media mornings in Australia, in the new issue of Monocle, the May issue. It starts his piece on page 99.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle.
And in the next half hour of the program, we'll review the Italian front pages with Monocle's David Pleasant, and we'll head down to Antarctica and talk branding.
There's lots of areas there that are rich in terms of what we can bring alive. The harmony, the fact that we were bringing diverse thinkers together in the scientific community, and then also the fact that we were trying to rally the world's key thinkers around the project and get them to get involved.
So a busy second half of the program here on Midori House. But before all that, here's Barney Burnham with the latest news headlines.
Thanks, Phil. Charges against the Mississippi man accused of sending ricin-laced letters to President Obama and two other officials have been dropped. A search of Paul Kevin Curtis's home failed to find incriminating evidence against him, and his lawyer claims he was framed. An eight-storey block housing garment factories and a shopping centre has collapsed on the outskirts of the Bangladeshi capital Dhaka, killing at least 25 people and injuring more than 500. A senior official said factory owners appear to have ignored a warning not to allow workers into the building after a crack was detected in the block yesterday. It's being reported that the name of Tamil Antanaev, the Boston Marathon bombing suspect killed in last week's manhunt, was on the US government's list of potential terrorists. But sources close to the investigation say the list is so vast that his inclusion did not mean authorities automatically kept close tabs on him. Two men arrested on Monday and accused of plotting a bomb attack on a Canadian passenger train have appeared in court and challenged the case against them. The authorities say their alleged plot had the support of Al-Qaeda in Iran. Afghanistan's President Hamid Karzai is holding talks today with the US Secretary of State John Kerry and officials from Pakistan. It's an attempt to improve relations between the neighbours after Afghanistan said earlier this week that its patience with Pakistan was wearing thin. The planned sale of 630 UK bank branches by Lloyds Banking Group to the Co-op Group has fallen through, leaving State Bank Lloyds to pursue a flotation of the business. The Co-op said it pulled out because of tough regulator requirements and the worsening outlook for UK economic growth. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. Barney will be back at the top of the hour with another check of the world headlines. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Steve Bloomfield. Now, this week on The Entrepreneurs, the team are heading deep into deserts, forests, valleys, and tundra to bring you business stories from the frontier.
BRR, a New Zealand branding agency, has built its reputation off the back of some of the country's most recognisable companies worldwide. They've had a hand in defining the personalities of the beer Steinlager, the renowned clothing manufacturer Icebreaker, and the healthcare technology giant Fisher & Paykel, among others. Recently, their work has taken them to an even further frontier, Antarctica, one of the world's most remote and inhospitable continents, to rethink and rebrand New Zealand's scientific interests there. Federico Monslave spoke to BRR's director, Julian Smith, about their work and how they have supposedly achieved a symbiosis between corporate identities and the larger New Zealand brand.
Yeah, so BRR, we're a creative and strategic company. We work with people to develop their stories, create their brands, often with people with a manila fold or an idea that we take and really look at how we might go to market. So we really pride ourselves on really innovative work, which really changes and transforms businesses. We work with a lot of New Zealand companies and look to grow their competitiveness globally. You know, we put a shingle on the door, so to speak, which said brand strategy company 25 years ago, and people thought we were just mad poets and really didn't get what we were about. But I think that, you know, with design thinking, and I think with brand and communications being more really understood internationally, but certainly more in New Zealand in the last 10 years, people really get what we do. And, you know, I think the key thing for us is to really deliver on the bottom line performance of brands. So the companies we work with, we really want to transform their companies and really add value. And we do exist in kind of a small market here in New Zealand, but increasingly overseas as well, where people are understanding and get a sense for our reputation for making a difference for companies. So it's really about, you know, really working in this area of brand, which is certainly not just about working in identities and logo development, but it is about transformation of companies and their categories.
One of the projects that kind of drove me to you guys and that I found quite interesting to begin with was the whole project with the New Zealand Antarctica Institute.
We'd previously done some work for Antarctica New Zealand, and they were looking at creating a research institute where we were bringing the best scientific minds, I guess, under the umbrella of the New Zealand Research Institute. And it was really a procurement exercise to look at ways that we could fund the research in Antarctica and, I guess, grow awareness for what Antarctica is and what it can provide to the scientific community. And so that was really how the project was birthed. So we had done some previous work quite a few years ago, and I guess they saw BRR as a really unique company that could look at the set of challenges and tackle it perhaps in a different way. And, you know, we worked really hard with them to begin with, just to uncover anything that had been done previously in the continent or for Antarctica before. And there wasn't a whole lot of material. You know, we had some great images. We certainly had some anecdotes around people that had traveled to Antarctica, but there wasn't a whole lot of design. There wasn't a whole lot of work creatively that had been put together for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. So the project, I guess, really connected with our value set as well. You know, we were very interested in projects that really do have that cause-related or altruistic kind of view. And I think that they saw us as someone that would think differently on the project rather than just kind of giving them a cookie-cutter approach or giving them something that had been sort of thought through before. We started by looking as much as we could at ways that Antarctica could be put forward in a communications perspective, but also looking at that community we were representing, which was the scientific community, and looking globally at the fact that it's the only continent where there hasn't been any wars. You know, there's lots of areas there that are rich in terms of what we can bring alive, the harmony, the fact that we were bringing diverse thinkers together in the scientific community, and then also the fact that we were trying to rally the world's key thinkers around the project and get them to get involved. So I think there was some material there that we thought was interesting early on. And I think the great brands often look to create metaphors or look to paint analogies rather than be too literal. And so what I personally did with my strategic team was really try to find a way that we could express a view of the project which would capture people's imaginations. So as we sent, you know, a very select amount of communication material and sort of information about the Institute out to Leonardo DiCaprio and Richard Branson and others, that they, and Prince Albert, that they would actually get a sense for what it was as a differentiated kind of set of materials. So that's where we developed the idea of the Earth's white box and painting the analogy of the black box in a plane and the fact that Antarctica holds a lot of secrets to the planet in terms of what's gone on before, and then clues to, scientifically clues for what we need to do in the future. And the idea kind of reveal and conceal was also played out as a party of that, to that. So strategically, I think it was really important for us to develop something where we could really springboard it off that platform.
Do you think about how it's going to be viewed, say, in China or in places that have very different aesthetic personalities and aesthetic ideas of what the world looks like? Do you have to conceptualize that sort of stuff? Or
I think to do this project justice, we had to think of it as a universal project, not just a New Zealand project. And as we talk to Antarctica New Zealand, we try to get a real sense for, you know, who's going to really embrace this. And it really was a global brief rather than a New Zealand brief. So yeah, certainly we know language, you know, there's a universal set of language there we think we've arrived at. There's a universal sort of sense of design language and the vernacular of design, which is very simple, kind of clean lines that we've portrayed. So I think all of those things had to be really well considered, yeah.
That was Julian Smith, director of New Zealand branding agency BRR, speaking to Federico Monsalve for this week's Frontiers-themed Entrepreneurs, which you can catch tonight at 1900 hours London time.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with the latest news from our man in Nairobi.
Globalist Asia is our brand new show covering global stories, but with a focus on what's shaping the business day from Beijing to Bangkok, Singapore to Sydney.
My vision of the Japan, how I see with this, is, I mean, I grew up in Paris, but that's how I see Japan.
There are also fresh insights from our global network of correspondents, contributors and editors, including a survey of the Asian front pages.
We're going to disagree to disagree, and we're just going to keep doing it and doing it and doing it, and no one really has a playbook for how this turns out at all.
So tune in to The Globalist Asia every weekday for your global news digest. That's The Globalist Asia at 3 a.m. in Hong Kong, 4 a.m. in Tokyo, and 6 a.m. in Sydney. Brought to you in association with GE.
Ever thought of shaking off those golden handcuffs? Or had a daydream about going solo, striking out, far from the gentle plod of your day job? Then it's time you tuned in to The Entrepreneurs. Every week, we meet the brave, intrepid, sometimes audacious businessmen and women who have done just that.
What we're trying to do is not create a fragrance, but rather evoke something through scents.
It's a show that allows you to learn business nouse by example. So, if you want to learn how to open a thriving organic bakery, patent a savvy invention, set up an artisanal microbrewery, or export a finely crafted product to the world, The Entrepreneurs is a living, working audio Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Steve Bloomfield. The time is 8:41 here in London, and it's 10:41 in Nairobi.
And time now for us to head to Nairobi, where Monocle's correspondent in the Kenyan capital, Tristan McConnell, is standing by. Tristan, good morning. I'm afraid we've got to start with some really horrible news. The death of another Somali journalist, Mohamed Ibrahim Raga. He's the fifth journalist in Somalia to be killed this year. It's over the last few years, it's become one of the most dangerous places in the world to be a journalist, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's certainly true. And it was kind of more understandable in a time when Mogadishu really was a war zone. We're talking a couple of years ago and prior to that, when really people were being killed all over the shop. There was kind of indiscriminate shelling, there were car bombs, suicide bombing, and so forth. But over the last 20 months or so, things have really calmed down in Mogadishu. No, this isn't the case all across Somalia, but in the capital, security is a whole lot better. And so civilian deaths and so forth are not happening in the way they used to. And yet we're still seeing a huge number of journalists being killed. I think it was around 18 last year. And as you say, we've just had the fifth one killed this year. So this year's not looking much better. And what we're seeing is really a variety of different attacks. And some of them are, it seems, just victims of circumstance. There were suicide bombings in restaurants where journalists have been sitting, and it doesn't seem as if they're being specifically targeted. But in other cases like this one, there are more like assassination attempts. It's very unclear who's behind it. Of course, the finger of blame is pointed at Al-Shabaab, the Islamic group, the jihadist group, but it's very unclear whether these journalists are being targeted for other reasons, whether it's by politicians or businessmen or what. But what we do know is that it remains an incredibly dangerous place for Somali journalists, despite the calming of the war there.
And do we have any sense yet of what this journalist may have actually been working on or covering, which may have led to his death, or even the other 18 who were killed last year?
Well, there is a lot of reporting in Somali domestic media about corruption in government, about dodgy business deals. So it's very hard to really narrow down to a particular story, any of these killings. But certainly, a lot of the journalists are involved in looking at how the politicians work together, how politicians articulate their business, and the backgrounds of some of these politicians. And some of them have incredibly checkered histories, as warlords during the days of the Civil War, and so on. So it's very hard to point the finger exactly at what they're reporting on and what might have led to the deaths. But to simply say, well, this is because the place is insecure, or this should be laid at the the door of Al-Shabaab, I think, is simplifying things and sort of being a bit disingenuous, really.
Okay, let's move next door almost to Uganda, or certainly next door to you, where President Yoweri Museveni has triggered a little bit of a criticism by handing over a sackload of cash.
Yeah, exactly. Now, President Museveni's been in charge since, 1986 now, and he's really, certainly over the last decade or so, sort of personalised power to a huge degree, and this is something we see in a lot of different African states. And that means that essentially state resources are used almost like his own piggy bank in order to further his political career. So, you know, he may not be stealing the money to, you know, stick in the Swiss bank account or buy himself a posh house on the French Riviera, but money is handed out, government money is handed out by individual politicians, in this case the president, in a way that kind of garners support for them. And what made this one really stand out was simply the scale of the cash. I mean, during elections in Uganda that I've been to, it's pretty commonplace to see, you know, envelopes of money passed around or small bills handed out to people who turn up at fiscal rallies. But we've never seen a sack with what came to the equivalent of $100,000 being given to, in this case, a youth group in the east of the country. I mean, the defense for this from the 70s people, and you know, let's not forget that it was the Presidential Press Service who highlighted this. They actually thought it was a good thing. They put the photo out, got the local papers to publish it, and then the backlash began. And what they said was they were simply fulfilling an election promise. You know, the 70s said to this youth group, we will support you, and look, here he is supporting them. But obviously, in a relatively poor country where corruption is a major problem, this has caused quite a furore.
And Museveni, he's got a bit of a history of giving out, you know, presents or gifts or cars, vehicles, and even cash, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, quite a number of those presents and gifts he seems to give to himself. He's got a couple of new Mercedes limousines, he's got a Gulfstream jet that he flies around in. I mean, in the name of the presidency, but of course, as I said, the presidency, the politics of Uganda are incredibly personalised. So it becomes more and more difficult to separate, you know, the state from the individuals who are running it. And this plays into, you know, elections and so on, where state funds are used to run election campaigns. And this really is just a follow-up to that. But no, you're right. I mean, Museveni does have something of a reputation nowadays for, you know, running these incredible patronage networks where any time he sees opposition, he'll simply buy them off, whether that's with a ministerial position or sort of goods, as it were. And that's done a wonder in kind of keeping him in power for so long.
Tristan McConnell, Monocle's man in Nairobi, thanks very much for joining us here on Midori House.
Now, Phil promised you music at the start of the show. Promised you music that I'd been humming.
You're
all day.
Very excited. I don't think I've ever seen you this excited.
Whatever.
The first thing you said this morning when you saw us, you said, "I've got the perfect song to play you guys."
I have. I played it yesterday on the Atlantic shift, and it made me feel incredibly summery, which was perfect because it was a beautiful summer's day. I think it's going to be a very beautiful summer's day here
Fingers
in London
crossed.
As well today. I certainly hope so. I'm fairly sure it's going to be a couple of members of Monocle staff in shorts for Fernando Augusto Pacheco managed it yesterday. I'm wondering whether the person you're going to hear on the other side of this song might be wearing shorts. No, he's making faces saying he might not be. David Pleasant is going to be in to review the Italian papers in a moment. But first, you will be humming this too. It's Daft Punk and Pharrell Williams. It is as good as you would expect. It's Get Lucky. Daft Punk, Pharrell Williams, Get Lucky. See, Phil? See?
I love this song.
Good.
I love this song.
Good.
I was going to say, yesterday we had Adrian Craddock on doing our newspaper review, and he sang that I Touch Myself song. I'm wondering if we should make David sing this song. Would that just be cruel?
Yeah, he did, apparently. There. Yeah. Let's not talk about that. David Pleasant is here with the Italian front pages in front of him and not wearing shorts, but a very summery shirt.
I'm trying.
Yeah, you are.
Yeah, top marks for trying, I think. Yeah, so I thought we'd start with La Stampa in Turin. They are leading, like a lot of the papers are, on Renzi, Matteo Renzi, the mayor of Florence seems to be the front runner to replace Bersani, who resigned last week as head of the Democratic Party. What's interesting is, I mean, there's a lot of talk and speculation about Renzi, but it's just whether he can amass the support needed to go ahead and lead the party, who that do have a majority in the lower house. So let's see if he can do that.
So Renzi, as you say, mayor of Florence, he's quite young, so he's still in his late 30s, isn't
exactly,
he?
Exactly, yeah.
And he was sort of... took on Pierluigi Bersani beforehand in the primary, hoped to become the centre-left standard-bearer in the last elections, lost out to Bersani. You get the feeling that the PD kind of feel they might have made a mistake last time.
Exactly. I mean, he was kind of the favourite. He was the populist, the one that everyone thought was going to change. His campaign was kind of exceptional and lots of people thought it was quite magnificent, but he didn't win, and that was, you know, all the kind of backfighting and the infighting within the PD. So let's see if he can have another stab and perhaps make it this time.
But it seems like this is also a bit of a non-starter, because Berlusconi already saying he will block the bid for premiership.
Yeah, which seems pretty strange considering he's not, you know, even in the PD, but obviously he's involved in the parliamentary process. So although some of Berlusconi's allies are backing Renzi's bid, or at least saying that they're not entirely against it. So let's see, maybe Berlusconi can be persuaded. The only thing is the kind of tussling between Renzi and Berlusconi. Renzi's been very formidable in his criticism of Berlusconi, so he's kind of put himself in quite a position against Berlusconi.
Well, indeed. And Berlusconi obviously wants to do whatever he can possible to prevent anyone other than himself becoming prime minister. How likely is it, though, that you know, regardless of what happens here, that Napolitano, the president, that the new president, the old president, both, is going to just say, you know what, guys, let's have another election, which may end up helping Matteo Renzi, mightn't it?
I think so. And I think a lot of the foreign press in particular have been very anti or scared by the thought of another election. As I've said before, I don't think that's such a bad idea. And the press certainly in Italy don't look at it as such a terrible situation. It's commonplace to have several elections to reach a decision in Italy. So, as you say, maybe Renzi might profit from that.
And you've got a copy of the Corriere della Sera there in front of you. More bad news.
Yeah, this is Grillo. He is, I mean...
Pepe Grillo from the Five Star Movement.
Exactly. Pepe Grillo is, I mean, it's just a constant kind of... He's coming out with all sorts of things every day. Late today, he's told the German press that Italy will be bankrupt by autumn. I don't know quite where he's got his figures, but he seems his prediction and the Five Star Movement's prediction is that the country will struggle with paying pensions and indeed state salaries by the autumn. Not really good news, and it's not being really seen as very helpful commentary from Grillo. He doesn't seem to be taking part very much in this bid to form a government, instead choosing to lash out at the state of the economy.
Let's end with the front page of Repubblica, and they're talking about what's happened in France yesterday. The way is free for gay marriage, they say. How is Repubblica looking at this? I mean, particularly given that obviously gay marriage isn't really on the agenda in Italy at the moment.
Well, yeah, that's the question. It's giving it a lot of coverage. Repubblica, centre-left, it is giving a lot and quite a lot of pages within the paper. But,
and its main photo on the front page is exactly of a same-sex couple.
Same-sex couple with the rainbow flag. I think it's getting all that bit more attention as France is, you know, the neighbour of Italy. It's always kind of everything that happens in France is looked at with a lot of attention. So let's see if this is kind of like a tipping point in terms of it's talking about the ninth state in Europe to go ahead with gay marriage. There are obviously some more enlightened voices within the Italian media who have been calling for the debate to at least start in Italy. Obviously, people on the right claim that the Republic is for everybody and therefore there's no need to protect certain citizens, which is their constant argument, which, you know, is slightly flawed, to say the least.
And obviously because of the influence of the Catholic Church as well, in particular, it's going to make it quite hard for this movement to make much progress.
Yeah, that's the thing. The one perhaps more positive fact, and we touched on last week, is Bergoglio, the new Pope, Francis I, has committed to not get involved in Italian politics. He seems to be backing away from it all. So that could be something of an opportunity.
And David, just very quickly, one last story here. A blessing in disguise for Italian traffic.
Yes, it's a kind of good and bad news story. So as the economy continues to plunge, traffic is also going down across Italy. So there's a quite shocking figure. Traffic went down by 34% last year. So that's good news if you want to get around on Italy's roads, but bad news perhaps if you're looking at the state of the economy.
David Pleasant, thank you very much for joining us. That is indeed all we have time for on today's Midori House. Thanks to our producer, Dawn Trump, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and James Bullock, and our studio manager, Alex Funnell. Up next after news, it's The Menu with Marcus Hippie. This week, they find out what you do after your restaurant's won the highest acclaim of World's Best Restaurant. And we also visit that brand new Monocle Cafe just up the road from us here at Midori House. Clemency Burton-Hill and Phil will be back here tomorrow with Midori House at the same time. But for now, I'm Steve Bloomfield.
And I'm Phil Hahn.
Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo to Buenos Aires,
to Zurich,
to Hong Kong,
to Tel Aviv,
to Toronto,
to Amsterdam,
to Berlin.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.